Welcome to the InfoQ Podcast, a software engineering podcast brought to you by the same team behind InfoQ.com. InfoQ.com is a software engineering news site which aims to help progressive software development teams adopt new technologies. We are also the people behind the international software conferences, QCon. My name is Wes Rice. I'm the conference chair and community advocate for QCon. Today, I'm here with Matt Rainey, who will be speaking at the upcoming QCon New York on June 13th through 15th in a track that's a favorite of QCon, Architectures You've Always Wondered About. Matt's QCon New York title, our talk, is entitled Scaling Uber to Thousands of Services. Matt's official title at Uber is Senior Staff Engineer. You know, Matt, before I got to know you a bit, I talked to some of the people that worked around you, and I kind of asked them a bit about you. I said, you know, what's Matt's real role? What's his real function there? And one person who I won't specifically name here said basically that every major architectural decision, every significant architectural decision at Uber, Matt has his hands in. That's a pretty awesome statement for a company like Uber that's gone through such massive growth. So Matt, welcome to InfoQ Podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So this is your third QCon, if I remember right. The first one was in London, then in San Francisco, and now New York.
That's true. I also did QCon Shanghai.
Oh, that's right. You sure did. So we'll have to get you a t-shirt or something. That's the full tour of all your talks at QCon. Thank you so much for being involved. So what's the motivation with this talk?
Well, let's see. As you mentioned, I've been to a number of QCons, and I've been to a lot of other conferences as well. But you know, both recently as part of Uber and just kind of in my career, and I started to notice. I started to reflect about if I was going to pick a conference to attend, like what would I want to get out of it? And I started to notice that there seemed to be like a little mismatch about like what I was getting from a number of these other architectures you've always wondered about tracks, which are all super interesting and super great. But a lot of them kind of left me feeling, I don't know, inadequate or bad. Like I somehow, like other people had it all figured out, but not me. And as I asked around, I realized that is sort of a common, that's something a lot of people feel, is that like, wow, Google sure has it all figured out. Like, I guess I'll try and learn, you know, what they're good at, but like, man, it's too bad my stuff all sucks. And I want to really question that, because as I have talked to a lot of people at these places, I realized that the kind of people who volunteer to go give talks are always about some new, awesome, shiny thing that they finally did just figure out. But meanwhile, the rest of their infrastructure is all various shades of legacy shambles, right? And so what I wanted to try to reflect is like the struggle, like this is hard, and let's acknowledge that this is really hard, but if there's some ways that you could save yourself some pain, I think that there's a way to, you know, to sort of make it less painful by sharing some learnings from people who have suffered, so you don't have to. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from this time.
So I love the idea of acknowledging the struggle and trying to save some people some pain. So what type of things will you be going into that might save some people some pain?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, of course, it's a general technology conference. I mean, so I'm going to say the word microservices, like, I don't know, 40 or 50 times. It's just sort of inevitable. But, that's an example of one of those things that I feel like before we had a lot of services, I was like, oh, all the cool kids have lots of services. That's definitely something that you should go get. And we did, and that was good, but there were a lot there, you know, like everything in engineering, it's a trade-off. And a lot of the trade-offs were not obvious. And like I will give you an example. Adopting microservices allows you to do is write your software in different programming languages. So you could have some stuff written in Node.js and some stuff written in Python and some stuff written in Go and some stuff written in Java. For example, in fact, a very specific example of our exact infrastructure where we have that exact situation. Some other like sprinklings of Scala or other. I think someone did an Elixir thing. Like, I don't know. Anyway, but you can do this, right? Like, that is what's neat about, that's the benefit of splitting things into microservices. And people, they can own their own release cycles and their own, their own alerting and be responsible for their own uptime. And this is really cool. But what's the downside? Like, at what cost? And a surprising thing to me is how much cost there was by having teams do stuff it was great that we had this framework to let people do things differently, but because they did things differently, the aggregate velocity in many cases was a lot slower, because now the Java people had to figure out how to talk to the metrics system, and so do the Go people, and so do the Node people, and now then sometimes they do it differently, and then there's some hard-fought bug on one platform that they fixed kind of has a similar shape, but like has to be similarly battled on the other platform. I hadn't expected the cost of multiple languages to be as high as it was, for example.
So if I remember right, your architecture's got a lot of Node.js on the front end, back end you've got a lot of Python, Java, C++. I'm sure there's a ton of other things in there. Can you kind of, using this sort of whiteboard of your mind, kind of go through what the rest of, or what Uber's architecture looks like? Give us kind of a picture.
Yeah, sure. So if you imagine on this whiteboard, like you said, the front end is mostly Node.js, and that's still definitely true. I'm trying to think of like, see how complicated we can get into with our mental whiteboard. We have deployments. We're since the last time, since a year or so ago, when we talked about this last, we've added some more kind of interesting aspects to it. Specifically, we are in many different data centers now. And so whereas before that was not the case, we had a primary and a fallback data center. But now we are in many data centers around the world to try to get, the data closer to our customers and for just availability reasons to sort of spread out a bunch across more failure domains. But so at the front end, we do TLS termination, and we're trying to push that TLS termination absolutely as close to the users as we can. And so we're using some cloud providers to do that, and sort of backhauling it into our infrastructure, where it then gets to onto the Node.js dispatch system. We call this marketplace now, because it is we have many more products other than transportation, and so we're delivering food and we're doing all manner of logistics products, and so. That whole part of the infrastructure is now called Marketplace. So Marketplace systems are still generally written in Node, although those are largely moving to Go at this point, or Go and Java. But still, like, that's just for new stuff that they're writing. The existing the bulk of that is all Node. And this is also the part of the system that like just absolutely has to be up. And so even brief outages are super bad. And so this is where we do aggressive failure testing and really require that the highest level of scrutiny about all the kind of changes that we make and the amount of engineering resources that are sort of deployed to making sure that goes that system stays up is the highest. And so this is where we have our React clusters that manage the kind of the state of all of the jobs that are in progress at any one time in Uber are maintained in various React clusters. And then when they complete when the jobs are over, they are moved over, sort of out of the marketplace system and then into various other systems that are related to sort of the rest of what you might call the business logic, I guess. And this is like, it's hard to draw a nice pretty picture of how all this works, but a lot of it flows through Kafka, And there are also a whole bunch of other kind of work queues that are sort of adjacent to that that execute like workflow. It's this kind of custom workflow stuff about like, you know, you got to get a receipt and then we need to prompt you to like, you know, rate the trip and just all that stuff about when this happens, do another thing. But that event might not happen for, you know, some time into the future. That's all maintained, in these systems. And then there's a whole mapping, the map services is the teams that that compute the ETAs, right, and the routes for your trip. And they their stuff is mostly in Java, and they've got some of the highest throughput systems are all the map systems. And those are worth a whole talk on their own, and I hope we can get somebody from the mapping teams to come do that at some point. And then of course we've got a big Hadoop ecosystem to do all the analytics, and that is kind of where all of the Kafka streams ultimately go is into a great big Hadoop. And I don't know, like, you probably lost track of where we started in the mental whiteboard, but
nah, it's clear as day.
Yeah, those are sort of all the big pieces.
Okay, so if you take all those big pieces, I guess the question I've got is how. The last time that we talked, I think you mentioned in the year and a half you've been there, you've seen about a 10 times growth in the size of the engineering teams.
Yep.
So how? How do you manage your architecture, your culture, engineering teams' velocity? How did you manage to do these things without just completely stepping all over each other with this kind of growth?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I guess I got to be honest, like, we don't have it all figured out. I mean, we are lucky that we have a very successful product, and everyone is very enthusiastic, and we are able to hire really, really good engineers. And so we have not. I mean, it's something that we're still actively trying to get, you know, to get better at. But luckily, because of all those things that we have going for us, even as we kind of stumble around and make mistakes and try to figure this stuff out, like, we're still able to keep on, you know, making progress and making the system work. But yeah, the growth rate of just like stacking that many engineers up on the same sets of problems so quickly, it definitely would not be possible if we weren't able to hire really good engineers. And it would also be much more efficient if we did it more slowly, like way more efficient if we did it more slowly. But the competition, especially if you consider the competitive landscape globally, is fierce. And we are working very, very hard to stay ahead of them. And that requires, you know, pushing hard up against a lot of conventional sort of limits of what you might think is a reasonable growth rate, for example. And so while I'm not, it's not efficient. Like, I'm just gonna, it's super not efficient, but we're getting better. We're making it more efficient all the time. And, you know, we are definitely learning as we go. I guess like one of the interesting things about this sort of culturally, that, you know, it's an interesting evolution that we've gone through, is because we are adding people so quickly that it basically would not have been possible if we weren't building things in lots of tiny services. Like, I don't think that there was any way we could have ever done it if we had to have some kind of organized top down, we figured out the architecture, isn't it wonderful and elegant. We really just had to make this loose collection of services that, you know, in aggregate made Uber work, because it was the only way to allow like independent progress from lots of teams of varying levels of experience. And that, you know, that culture, for better or for worse, doesn't always, like, it's not always cohesive. And so we're trying to You know, like you might not even ever know who the other teams are who are, you know, using your thing. And like, that's weird. And so that's definitely something that we're working on, that we, to try to give everybody a clear picture of kind of where their system fits into the, you know, into the broader architecture, and just sort of get a little bit more consistency about the way that we do things, so that it's easy to just go read some other team's source code, and it doesn't it doesn't seem like, wow, look at how this team does it. Like, it's like hard to understand. Like, it puts up some artificial barriers, I guess, to sort of working, you know, to team cohesiveness. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I guess it goes with my general theme of this is a struggle, and there are some like there are some interesting things about that.
Sure. It totally ties into your theme that this is hard, and these are some thoughts and pitfalls you might run into.
Yep.
So what about things like maybe your build pipeline in such a high velocity polyglot environment? I mean, is each team completely responsible for their own pipeline? How do you deal with like cross-cutting concerns, things like logging and diagnostics? I guess, what does that look like at Uber?
Right. So we definitely have a team that manages the build and deploy pipeline. That's an in-house system that we built. I mean, we use Jenkins and, you know, some other open source stuff, but there's a bunch of in-house developed automation that kind of runs the, you know, manages the process end to end, you know, and actually sort of gets your service into production. So there's a team that manages that, and you know, we have like cool internet companies, we have an observability team, because it's really cool to call it observability. That sounds like way better than metrics or, you know, data or something. It's like, wow, observability, you guys are on it. So we have one of those, and it's great. So but it's like a hard problem. It's a really hard problem, and so, you know, that's, we have a team that manages that, and similarly to, you know, for logging, like a big challenge that the Kafka team has is there are four different languages and, you know, no single, not even four client libraries. There are many client libraries, and like, this is hard, and that is their challenge, is making, producing and consuming via Kafka viable in four different languages.
So I've got this image of this person out there listening to this podcast thinking, how am I ever going to do this? If Uber doesn't have this together, how am I going to get this together?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's of course a hazard, but I think I'm emphasizing the flaws, but they need, you know, you need the perspective, of course, that the reason we have this problem is because the business is incredibly successful, and it like that has a way of just sort of like fixing a lot of problems, you know, like the business keeps working, like you'll find a way. And so we have the level of chaos that we have because of the level of the business success. And I think if you are listening to this and you are in a business with crazy, crazy growth of the actual business, I bet this sounds very similar, like maybe at a different scale, like who knows. But I think that the learnings you can sort of see by kind of amplifying this trend, like you can see elements. I think even when I was working in companies that were growing more slowly, there were elements of these same things. And I think it's just by really just maximizing these factors, that's made them more clear to me. And so yeah, I mean, I think you can get it together. Like, everybody figures out a way to get it together. And I also think that you have, like, it looks different on the outside versus on the inside. And so when you see just having someone else explain how they do a thing, you might think, wow, that's a good idea, or maybe that's a bad idea. But like, you can always sort of like that external input, I hope, is useful in just like seeing where they made what trade-offs and how they, where, what side they came down on different trade-offs, and there's always something to be learned. And whether or not like you want to make a judgment about like it's good or bad, I think that there's always something to learn about hearing how people do a thing. So I don't know. I guess it's dangerous that if you conclude that anybody has it does or doesn't have it figured out. But I hope people will at least find something that they can learn.
That I have absolutely no doubt, Matt. I thoroughly enjoy your talks and I'm looking forward to it in New York. So I'd like to shift gears just a bit. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Adrian Cockcroft, and he was talking about, you know, innovative architectures. And he made a comment in particular where he said, if you really want to see some of the more innovative things that are going on right now with software, go see what Matt Rainey's up to at Uber. So I know you probably can't share too much, but of what you can share, could you tell us a bit about some of the things that you've got going on there?
Yeah, sure. Certainly appreciate the praise from Adrian there. We're doing a number of things that I think are pretty interesting, and I think that the reason that we're doing this is because as we're sort of trying to figure out how to adapt to this growth, we were able to hire really knowledgeable people from a lot of companies that have done, have operated big scale systems before. And so we were able to get a lot of good introductions at other big companies and learn as much as we could. And so we were definitely able to go around and talk to people at a Google or a Facebook or a Twitter or a Microsoft and just understand how they worked on how they address these different kinds of problems. And so I think that definitely helped a lot, and we're definitely borrowing bits from all of those conversations. And so I think that our in production stuff that's in production right now that's pretty interesting is the Ring Pop system that we're doing, which is kind of inspired by the I'm blanking on the name with the Microsoft Orleans. It's inspired by that. It takes it a little bit of a different way, but that's most of our marketplace systems are based on Ring Pop. It's on our GitHub, so you can check that out. And we're building, I think, a lot of the next generation of new architectural stuff that we're working on now. I think is going to be very, very interesting, along the lines of our RPC protocol, and trying to take what good elements of how Google does RPCs and how Twitter and some other companies do it. And that is all going to be open sourced. Although I think our next generation one is still they haven't flipped the public bit on that repo yet. But that's going to be pretty interesting. And so that's stuff like that. I think is really cool. We have some other, I don't know, basically like so a few other systems that we're working on that I think they all share this same design of. We want to be able to do aggressive failure testing on every component in production without users noticing. And it doesn't matter what that system is used for, whether it's marketplace or not. We don't want to build anything that we cannot subject to aggressive failure testing. And so there are a lot of solutions out there that do not hold up well to aggressive failure testing. And so a lot of the things that we're building right now are like, if I could generalize and perhaps like why I think a lot of this stuff is so interesting, it's our focus on that, like just really, really like fault tolerant systems.
So when you talk about aggressive failure testing, what does that mean for Uber? Can you dig into that a bit?
Yeah. So I mean that's like our version of Chaos Monkey. I mean, it means, or the, in the entire Netflix Simian army, Once again, good ideas that that we went around and learned what we could from. We're not on Amazon. I mean, we're partially on Amazon, but we also run a lot of our own data centers, and so the Simian Army doesn't. While it's open source, it doesn't necessarily help us because we have a very different infrastructure. So we built a similar system, although it's nowhere near as advanced as some of the Simian Army components are after all the time that Netflix has put into it. But we're definitely embracing that philosophy, you know, as much as we can. About you got to be able there cannot be any special nodes, special components in the system that if you are ever afraid that you like what will happen if a node in the system breaks, then that's not a good design. Like we want to only deploy things that anyone for any reason can just take a node down and it's the users will not notice. So that, I mean, that's kind of the main way that we're trying to address this, you know, this crazy chaos, is to like add some chaos of our own under controlled circumstances, so that when unexpected things happen, they will likely be handled gracefully.
You know, as you've been talking, I kind of can't help but think about some of the other people I've spoke to for QCon New York. Talked to Shanti Allen from Sundance and Katie McCaffrey from Twitter. Both of them are talking about verification and distributed systems. So it's got me kind of wondering, what about the other side? So I hear you talking about failure, but what about kind of verification of distributed systems? What types of things does Uber do to verify that the system's correct in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, that is a tricky problem for sure. I mean, we are doing a few things along those lines. The main, obvious thing is where, we have an integration test suite and, that tries to like run traffic in a simulated environment between as many pieces as we can, for sure. But there are a couple of other things that we're doing, I guess they seem unrelated, but I assure you they're related. One is just sort of backing up a step. It's kind of hard to verify how the systems are supposed to work together if you don't actually know what the contract is between those things. And we may have forgotten to formally specify some of those contracts over time, and given the language situation, the specifications may have diverged in ways that happened to still work, but neither side realized that they were still working. And so, like, a big problem with this is we built all of our early stuff with JSON over HTTP. And it was really, really hard. It's really, really hard to validate those interfaces. And so we are moving to, getting type safe interfaces between all of our services. I think that is one of the biggest learnings that that I have now, is like, I never foresaw the cost of using this user-friendly, developer-friendly, at the time, type-unsafe JSON strings as exchanging data between services is just a massive accrual of debt at some level. And it may indeed be slightly slower to work with as a human being, but eventually, like, you're going to have to pay for that. Pay for that convenience that you enjoyed a while back. And so the first thing that we have to do is actually get interfaces that are type safe and verifiable between all of our components, and that is a major, major undertaking. So the first step is actually just understanding and building verifiable interfaces. And sort of in parallel to that, because that is such a big effort, We are doing black box testing with big fleets of mobile phones, like big fleets of mobile phones around the world that are just taking trips all day long. And so, there is an army of them, and they are just all day long just picking each other up and dropping each other off and asking for rides. And is like a, that is a whole thing. And that's, I'm sure that we will want to do that just for absolute ever, because there's nothing, there's nothing like actually like, running, driving the system with a mobile phone to see if it's working correctly. But we would like to be able to catch problems before they're released, and we'll get there. But we gotta build interfaces that we understand between everything first. So we're unfortunately a little behind the curve on that one.
Matt, if you're behind the curve on that one, you're ahead of the curve in many, many other areas. Thanks for spending some time chatting with us. If you like what you heard, you can hear Matt's full talk about lessons he's learned scaling over to thousands of services at the upcoming KubeCon New York. In addition to talks like Matt's, you can learn lessons from leading software companies in areas focused on distributed systems, antifragility, streaming data, and much, much more. Visit kubeconnewyork.com to see the complete lineup. Thanks again for joining us on the InfoQ podcast.